Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Claire Roth, filling in for Ann today. For millions of Americans, pets are family. Owners want to make sure that they live happy and healthy lives. But veterinary costs can be a real burden, and pets don't always necessarily get the care that they need. Also, even with the best care, pets don't live forever, and the pain of losing a beloved companion can be hard to process. The Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine is confronting these realities with special programs that provide outreach support to pets and owners alike. Dr. Rustin Moore is the dean of OSU's College of Veterinary Medicine, and he joins me now. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been a vet for nearly more than 30 years. How has the field changed in those three decades for you?
Yeah, the field of veterinary medicine has really changed over the last 30 years, really becoming more specialized in many ways, just like in human medicine. Certainly, we have general practitioners or what we would refer to as family veterinarians, much like family healthcare. And they do a tremendous job, and many times they may find something that they want or need to refer. And so we, in the last 30 years, many specialties in veterinary medicine have developed, whether it be cardiology or oncology or many of the other ones. And so that's probably one of the biggest. The other thing is not so much in veterinary medicine, although it impacts veterinary medicine, is I would say socially or culturally, pets have become humanized.
Really?
Over the last 30 years.
And you feel like that's a more recent development?
I think it's gradually increased over the years, certainly at least since I've been a veterinarian. But the majority of people, upward of 90% of people who have a pet, view the pet as a member of their family.
We have a story in my family, it's very famous, where our beagle Chance ate a bunch of rat poison. And my mom had gone to the vet. And one of the questions was, is your dog just a pet or a beloved member of the family? And she points it out all the time, because when it's a beloved member of the family, you will do almost anything to make sure it's okay. And you've
Absolutely.
Seen that.
Absolutely. Yes, we have people, you know, we see about 45,000 patients in our hospitals each year. And, you know, all types of people and all types of pets come in. But regardless of the socioeconomic status of the client that comes in, they absolutely want to do the best thing possible to save that pet.
So when you look at this kind of human-animal bond, and you say that animals have become more humanized, they've kind of increased in our eyes as far as their import goes, how has that changed the way that vets approach their work?
Well, I think we've always done that. Veterinarians tend to be a pretty compassionate group of individuals, but certainly because people view their pets as family members, they many times are willing to do more for their pet, and therefore many of the advanced techniques and procedures that have been developed over the years has allowed us to offer those, which really has helped to improve the health and well-being. For example, used to be years ago, if a dog or cat had cancer, that was sort of the end, but now we're able to provide a variety of different therapies for those, and many of those can be either extend the life, extend the quality of life, or potentially cure the cancer.
We're talking about some of these specialized procedures. How widely available are those? We're in a big city here in Columbus. We have one of the best vet med schools in the country right here. There's obviously some benefits to that, but I'm assuming that access isn't that available for every person, even here in Central Ohio.
Yeah, advanced veterinary medicine is, I would say, relatively accessible here in Central Ohio because in addition to our academic veterinary medical center, there are a number of private specialty hospitals. However, even people in Central Ohio can't necessarily access that because of cost and therefore or their financial status. And certainly as you get further and further out of an urban center into rural areas, many of those areas are underserved, not just by specialty veterinary medicine, but also even by general practice. There are about 500 counties throughout the U.S. that are considered underserved by a veterinarian.
Wow. And when you look at those counties, how do we fix that problem? Because assuming it's one, at least in part, a populace, right? If there's not a critical number of animals that need care, it would be hard to make your living as a veterinarian in a sparsely populated county.
You're absolutely right. Those areas that are sparsely populated with a veterinarian or are underserved are those areas that are socioeconomically not able to support a veterinarian, particularly when someone graduates with over $200,000 of debt. Mm-hmm. And that creates a real issue. And that's one of the reasons our new initiative called Spectrum of Care, which is really a new way to really train and prepare our veterinary students to go into the field, is so that they have more confidence, competence, and career readiness so that they can provide a broad spectrum of care or options to clients and pets so that you sort of tailor or customize the treatment to whatever financial status the client has. And also you customize it across a broad socioeconomic array. And that's something that's really important, whether it's in rural Ohio or in inner city Columbus.
So do you feel that you have seen an increase in pet owners who are unable to pay for the care that their animals need?
Absolutely. There was a study done recently that showed there's about 23 million pets that live in areas that are considered underserved by veterinarians. About 87% of those are not spayed or neutered, and 77% of those have never seen a veterinarian.
Wow.
And that in itself is just a snapshot of some of the issues that we deal with. And we see it here every day in Columbus, certainly in our specialty referral hospital on emergency. Our colleagues, the general practitioners in the field here, they see it. And then we see a lot of it on our outreach programs.
Help us understand the importance of that, because I feel like as a society, we have broadly understood preventative care is important for human health. You need to go to a primary care physician and kind of get a checkup. That is just generally good practice. Is the same true for an animal?
Absolutely. Preventive care is one of the most important things you can do. Everything from making sure your pets are vaccinated for those infectious diseases that are contagious, that those things can truly prevent one of those diseases. Certainly also trying to maybe diagnose a condition or a disease early in its onset so that you can manage it. Say diabetes is an example, mm-hmm. but there's many others, and you can manage those so that they don't get severe. You might even detect an early cancer that you could treat before it gets too far advanced. So the other thing is nutrition and weight management. Many dogs particularly, but cats also, do become obese. Part of that is related to their lifestyle, but part of it's related to their diet. So all of those preventive measures are really important and can prevent some of the morbidities or conditions that can really impact their health and well-being.
We're talking about modern veterinary medicine today on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a story of your animal, how you struggled to get care for your animal, and how you overcame that, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking with Dr. Rustin Moore. He's the dean of OSU's College of Veterinary Medicine, and you've been the dean there since about 2015. What sort of changes have you been implementing in those 5 years?
Well, we've been implementing a number of things for some time, but certainly in the last 5 years, we've really moved toward activities and services that are aligned with our new strategic plan. Our ambition for our strategic plan is to be the model comprehensive college of veterinary medicine in the world, and that includes being the model in education as well as outreach and engagement. So one of the things that we've been doing is building upon our veterinary medicine outreach program that started in 2009. We initially started that with Life Care Alliance and Meals on Wheels, where we were going out one day every 2 weeks to once a month. We now provide outreach services to 4 days a week for about 9 different community organizations. And these are organizations in the community that help provide care to vulnerable populations of people. Could be homebound elders, could be homeless, could be low income, could be veterans, could be HIV/AIDS patients and others. And what we know about those populations of people, just like with others, is the pet is the most important thing in their life. They will do anything for the pet. They'll feed the pet their meal before they eat. Mm. They'll somehow seek veterinary care or try to before they will get care for themselves. And part of that's because of the unconditional love that the pet shows. The pet doesn't care how they smell, what they look like, what they're wearing, if they have a car. They also can help relieve stress and anxiety. And certainly many of the homeless are veterans. Many of them have depression or anxiety or Alzheimer's or other things. And there's a lot of known positive health benefits on those populations of people simply by interacting with a pet.
And I think that that's something people can struggle to understand, especially people that don't own pets. They think if you're already in a vulnerable situation, why would you add another responsibility on top of all of the other struggles you have to deal with?
Well, I hear that a lot, and that's an interesting question. And some people will actually say, well, if you can't afford a pet, you shouldn't have one. And I disagree with that. I mean, certainly it would be nice if everybody had the resources to ideally care for their pet. But again, those people, to the best of their ability, will take absolute wonderful care of the pet. They may just not have the resources to seek veterinary care. Mm. So by us providing this, one thing it does is it preserves and strengthens that human-animal bond and it keeps that pet with that person, which can really have tremendous benefits. And we interact with these individuals all the time, and our fourth-year students get an opportunity to go out, again, 4 days a week. And I hear from our students that it's the most transformational experience in their whole veterinary medical education. And that's because they don't see or get to interact with this population or these populations of people in our veterinary medical specialty hospital. I say that it does three things in addition to enhancing the clinical and professional competencies of our students. It actually helps build cultural competencies and raise social awareness for our students because, they don't see or interact with these people typically. And the other thing it does is it instills civic responsibility in them. And I hear many of them say that when they graduate, they will continue to provide, you know, some volunteer services to help these types of populations of people, regardless of where they end up with their career.
Well, and you're talking about the spectrum of care, really trying to understand all of the different types of people that own pets, the different situations that pets can live in, and how to care for them. How do you teach that? You know, beyond going out and I guess the real world experience, there's such diversity in what people might come across. How do you prepare vet students for that while still trying to teach them how to take care of cats and dogs and all sorts of animals?
That's a really wonderful question. And it's something that we've really started to embrace and lead the area of veterinary medical education recently. How we do that is we actually focus on, if we're teaching a student about a certain condition or injury or whatever, we talk about all of the options that are available to provide appropriate levels of care for that pet. It may not, on one end, it may be referred to a specialist. On the other end, it may be keep it in your practice and do X, Y, or Z. And you have to have a very real, genuine conversation with the client, and you have to work within their means. Certainly, veterinarians can't give away their services because, again, they do carry a lot of debt when they graduate. But veterinarians will work with almost any client to find something to do to help the pet that is within their range. And what we have to do as an educational institution is provide those learning experiences while they're in school. So, for example, we're getting ready to break ground on a new spectrum of care clinic in the spring, and it'll be open the following June. It's called the Frank Stanton Veterinary Spectrum of Care Clinic. And in that clinic, our fourth-year veterinary students will be the doctors, and our faculty doctors will be the coaches. Oh. They will be observing through one-way windows and listening in through headphones, and they will only intervene if needed. And they'll get excellent care, and the faculty member will go in at the end to speak with the client and see if they have any questions, because by state law, we do have to have a veterinarian of record. But this, we believe, will increase our students' competence, confidence, and be more ready to go out and practice spectrum of care when they get a job in the community.
We're talking about modern veterinary medicine on 89.7 NPR News, All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Claire Roth in for Ann today. And if you have something you'd like to add, if you've had struggles to get veterinary care, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 614-292-8513. With us on the line now is Lisa from Columbus. Lisa, what did you want to add to the conversation?
I wanted to add that years ago, I had a dog who was diagnosed and treated for cancer at Ohio State University Vet Hospital, and he ended up passing away, and they asked very nicely if they could use his body for science and learn something from whatever unique cancer he had. And I wanted to emphasize that it's important that people realize that Ohio State's a learning college and those kinds of things can happen there too.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for that comment. Really appreciate that, Lisa. And there is research happening at your school as well. It's not just about training vets. You're trying to find the cures, right?
Yes, thank you so much for that comment. Actually, comparative and translational oncology, which is a fancy word for cancer, is one of our areas of strength or our signature program. And we have a wonderful veterinary clinical trials office that we see hundreds, if not more, pets per year. And we are able to enroll these pets with owner's permission into them. This provides a number of things. It provides access of that pet to the potentially the newest, latest, greatest treatment. There's financial incentives for the client. And most importantly, not only could it help that pet, it could help future pets as well as people because of One Health. We know that many diseases, including cancer, are very similar between animals and people. So many of the clinical trials that we do in our patients with naturally acquired cancer, as an example, we utilize therapies that are in the pipeline for human cancer. And what we've learned is if it doesn't work in a dog, it's not likely to work in a person or a human with cancer, and so it helps expedite and decrease the cost of drug development. But we also, as the caller indicated, we do collect tissues for different cancers, and we can bank those and use those to help in our research to try to find new either treatments or new cures for both animals and people.
Dr. Rustin Moore is Dean of the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine. We are talking about modern veterinary medicine and access today on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be back in just a moment with more All Sides. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Claire Roth, in for host Ann Fisher today. When a pet gets sick, owners naturally want to give their companions the best care possible. But sometimes even the most basic veterinary care is out of financial or geographic reach, and owners are forced to go without. The Veterinary Outreach Program at OSU is working to confront that reality while giving students valuable experience. Still with us is Dr. Rustin Moore, the Dean of OSU's College of Veterinary Medicine. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you.
And joining us now is Dr. Lori Millward, the Assistant Professor of Clinical Community Practice at OSU's College of Vet Med. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
So tell me about your program that focuses on in-home visits.
Sure. We started this program back in 2010. So it's
been
around, 10 years. It was started by two faculty members, Larry Hill and Linda Lord, to reach out to the community to initially just provide wellness care one day a week. It was a smaller program at that time. And we partnered with Life Care Alliance initially to just work with a small number of clients who demonstrated financial need for this particular program. And then over the years, it's steadily grown with most recently when I was hired in 2015 in my current position, we were able to expand the program by hiring more technicians, hiring more doctors. And so we were able to increase our outreach efforts from one day a week to 4 days a week.
So tell us how this works. Is this essentially house calls for pets?
Some of what we do is. So that is one of our projects in the outreach program. We partner with other community agencies. It's important to just mention that in order to be involved in these programs, our clients have to be a part of these partner agencies first. And we've grown so much recently that we are not taking any new patients at this time, unfortunately. But we partner with these other agencies, and they do the financial screening for us. So a lot of these individuals or these pet owners are older. They may be homebound. They may have chronic illnesses or financial constraints that prevent them from being able to provide their pets with basic wellness care.
So when you look at especially seniors who have these pets who are often very secluded, can you help us understand what these pets mean to them, what they offer to their quality of life?
They mean everything to them, Claire. It's probably the best thing I've done in my career so far is to see that love and that connection with that individual and their pet. And it goes both ways. The pet owner experiences benefits from having that pet, and the pet experiences the love from that pet owner. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful human-animal bond to witness.
So help us understand some of the problems that pets can have when their owners can't afford or otherwise can't get the vet care that the pet needs.
Yeah, so a whole bunch of things can happen, especially as the pet ages. We see more and more, various medical issues as that animal ages. Primarily, we focus in the outreach program on wellness care. Mm-hmm. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, so to speak, as they say. But we focus on providing vaccinations, core and also other non-core vaccinations for dogs and cats. We also provide heartworm testing as well as feline retrovirus testing as well. So the health conditions that you were asking about can vary. We see a lot of dermatological issues, flea infestations, secondary skin infections, ear infections, things like that. Mm. And we're able to help those mild medical concerns to some degree. But the more serious illnesses, we refer to local veterinary providers.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Moore and I were talking in the first segment about an increase in the need for care across a spectrum of care, as Dr. Moore put it. And in the 10 years that this program's been going on, in the 5 years that you've been in it, how do you feel you've seen the trends grow? I mean, you talked about how much demand there was for your program. Are you seeing more people who need this kind of care for their pets?
Yes. And I think we're learning more about this lack of veterinary care that meets the needs of the specific population in our communities. And we're seeing a movement now across many different universities that are focusing on helping this problem, this limited access to veterinary care. And the more we learn about it, the more we see there's a need for it. Mm. And you're right, we opened our program to 4 days a week, and within a couple of months, we were absolutely full.
And another part of this outreach that OSU Vet Med is doing is a program called POP Care. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about POP Care, because it doesn't just focus on the pet's health.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So POP Care stands for Pet Owner and Pet Care. And it was a new project that was launched in calendar year 2019. And it's a collaborative effort between the College of Veterinary Medicine, the College of Nursing, and the College of Social Work. It's a really exciting pilot program that we started with funding from the Rita and Alex Hillman Foundation. And we started to provide wellness and preventive care for the human and the pet at the same time in their home.
So it's like a dual checkup.
It is. And it was wonderful to see the benefits that providing health care to the human at the same time that we are providing care to the pet, we got better outcomes as a result.
Why do you think that is?
I think that the way to break down barriers for the human health care side of things is through their pets. And to explain that more, we would usually start with veterinary care with those clients. We would provide the needed vaccinations for their dogs and cats, but it was through our kindness and our gentle handling of their animals that the owners started to feel more comfortable with us in general and started to trust our team. Mm. So therefore, they were more open to receiving recommendations from the nursing team and as well as the social work team about ways they can take better care of themselves and also accessing different community resources that would benefit them.
Well, and those conversations are really, really tough. Having a discussion about your physical health, especially if you haven't been able to connect to the resources that you need, there can be an unfair shame that's associated with it.
Absolutely.
But the pets can kind of act as something that breaks down that barrier, acts as a bridge almost.
It was a really neat thing to see. We didn't think of that as a possibility for an outcome in that program, but the whole team noticed that as we went through the year.
We're talking about a specific program that addresses financial need when it comes to taking care of pets. But for those people that can't take part of a program like this, what sort of advice do you give for folks that are having a hard time getting veterinary access for their pets? Dr. Moore?
Well, as I mentioned in the first segment, veterinarians in general are a very compassionate, kind group of folks. And although we can't give away our services to everyone, most veterinarians, in fact, in a recent survey, over 90% of veterinarians that were surveyed said that every pet, regardless of its situation, if it's owned, and regardless of the economic situation of its client or its owner or pet parent, deserves some level of veterinary care. So most veterinarians will work with the client to provide some level of care. Sometimes it's not just financial. Sometimes it's transportation. Mm-hmm. And most veterinarians, in terms of small animal or companion animal care, don't provide ambulatory care or mobile care. Now, certainly those who provide mixed animal, they certainly go to farms. And so a lot of it is more about access and getting them to the veterinarian. And that's why one of the goals that we have is for this Pop Care program is to be able to scale it up, even out in communities where academia is not present. What we do know, and I mentioned this earlier, is that a person will do for their pet what they won't do for themselves. Mm. So if we can get them into a veterinarian to have their pet evaluated, and at the same time we have human healthcare workers present, we believe, and there's some programs that are being started, at least in Canada, where we believe that is a wonderful example of a One Health approach to the health and well-being of animals and people.
Well, and something that's come up is the concept that if you have a healthy pet, there's a big quality of life increase, especially for older folks that might be relatively isolated otherwise. So even just having a healthy pet would maybe increase their health.
Absolutely. And the one thing that we were seeing, Claire, is we were able to start to get clients to embrace smoking cessation programs when we were able to explain the health concerns that we had for their animals being exposed to secondhand smoke. And also, if we could come up with a weight loss plan for the pet that would include exercise, that would also benefit the human because they would be going out on walks with their pet more often.
That's fascinating. We're talking about changing vet med and access to care for pet owners across a spectrum of care. If you have had struggles getting veterinary care or a story you'd like to share about your pet and how it got health care, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You've talked about this program being in place for 10 years. You're full up now, but when you look to the future, what do you hope for the program?
Oh, gosh, I think the sky is the limit. The need is there, and the need is in every community, as Dean Moore says. I'd love to increase the educational component of what we do, expand more opportunities to our preclinical veterinary students. Most of the time when they're in their first through third year of veterinary school, it's very didactic in nature. They're in lecture halls 8 hours a day, but to be able to get them to be involved in these programs or these projects more so that they can get that hands-on experience will just build their confidence in their skills at an earlier time.
Mm. And we've been talking about the broader question of access. Is there a push in veterinary schools to people going out to more rural areas or places that are underserved? How do you get people excited about living somewhere or working in a place that might, you know, not be as tantalizing as a big city to a young person?
Well, that's a very important question that all veterinary schools are facing.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons it's difficult is because fewer and fewer of our applicants are coming from rural America. A smaller and smaller percentage of our population are living in rural America. And it's my contention, if we do not bring in students from rural America and provide them with a veterinary medical education, we're going to have a very difficult time getting others to go there. If you grew up in middle of Columbus or New York City, it's pretty unlikely you're going to have maybe a desire or a reason to go to somewhere that's more rural or particularly in Appalachia. Mm-hmm. If we can recruit students from those areas, provide them with the resources they need, and most importantly, make the education accessible and affordable so they don't have such a high debt load, I'm confident and believe that we can actually address this problem. And as I mentioned, there are 500 counties in the U.S. estimated to be underserved, and almost all of those are rural.
Dr. Rustin Moore, Dean of the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine, thank you so much for coming on the program today. You'll be sticking with us for the third segment. And Dr. Lori Millward, Assistant Professor of Clinical Community Practice at Ohio State University's College of Vet Med, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you for having me.
We are still talking about pets and access to veterinary care. If you have a story you'd like to share, give us a call at 614-292-8513. You can also send us an email at allsides@wosu.org. I'm Claire Roth, in for Ann Fisher today. We will be back with more in just a moment. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Claire Roth, subbing today for host Ann Fisher. We are talking about the hardships that pet owners face and some programs through Ohio State aimed at improving the health and well-being of pets and humans alike. One of the hardest aspects of owning a pet is knowing that they won't be around forever. Decisions at the end of a pet's life can bring stress and heartache. Honoring the Bond is a program at Ohio State, one of only about 30 in the country, that provides a full-time social worker to support pet owners that are faced with the loss of their companion. Still with us is Dr. Rustin Moore, the dean of OSU's College of Veterinary Medicine. And joining us now is Joelle Nielsen. She's a social worker and the program coordinator of Honoring the Bond. Thank you for coming today.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us how this program got started.
Wow. So it was kind of an organic process, and I don't even have exact dates. So my predecessor's name was Dr. Jennifer Brandt, and she started working with the College of Veterinary Medicine in the late 90s, around 98. Started with teaching some classes to the vet students on human-animal bond, also pet loss issues, and she was coordinating a pet loss hotline that we used to have. And it kind of evolved into her working with students and training students, but then also into working with clients at the veterinary hospital. And then it morphed into a program that started in the early 2000s with her providing the services to the animal owners within the veterinary medical center.
Yeah. So tell us what that looks like.
Sure.
What does a meeting between a social worker and someone who's facing the death of their pet or going through it, what does it look like?
Yeah. So my role is very similar to that of a social worker that works in a human hospital. So I'm dealing with crises. I do lots of different things, but the typical situation is helping those owners making those quality of life and end of life decisions. So, for example, a veterinarian may call me, and I do. I kind of do crisis. It's like I don't do a lot of scheduled appointments. Most of the work I do is the veterinarian calls me and says, "We've got someone in an exam room right now with their pet. Can you come talk to them?" It's usually people that are making really difficult treatment decisions or decisions about end of life. And so it's me spending time with them, that the veterinarians don't always have. So mm-hmm. I may spend an hour with an owner discussing their options, discussing the pros and cons of different choices that they might make, and helping guide them to what is going to be best for both them and their pet. So it's very much in the moment work. I work in the hospital. My office is actually in the veterinary medical center. Having those decisions, a lot of times those decisions end up with a euthanasia. So mm-hmm. In those cases, I'm typically present to provide support to the owners during that process. So the veterinarians are taking care of the animals, and I'm there for the humans. And that's kind of how we introduce me to people, too.
Yeah. Well, and to me, it makes a lot of sense because it's a very different skill set. Working through grief is not necessarily something that a veterinarian will have been trained for, whereas a social worker such as yourself with that sort of training will have a whole toolbox
sure.
to help people with that hard, hard situation.
Sure, absolutely. Now, the reality is that there's very few of us social workers, so the veterinarians do, as Dr. Moore said earlier, are quite compassionate people. And so some of what I do is also training the students. And so if they happen to work with me with a client, the veterinary students are often welcome in the room with me, because the reality is when they go out into private practice, they are going to be doing those things on their own. So really, it's kind of multi-factored. I'm not only providing support for the owner, but also educating the students at the same time.
Yeah, you're teaching. And Dr. Rustin Moore, the Dean of OSU's College of Vet Med, we had an email come in from Brenda, and she asked something that really relates to what Joelle's talking about here. She asked, what is OSU doing in their vet school training to prepare students for the emotional toll that this important profession can take? And that really strikes me, because it is, you're seeing death all the time and you're watching people go through very, very difficult times. And often there isn't someone like Joelle there to help the person or to help you.
Well, Brenda is very astute in her question, and I really appreciate that question. Many of our listeners may not know that in veterinary medicine, we tend to have a very high level of depression, anxiety, distress, stress, suicidal ideation, and suicidal completion, one of the highest. And there's a number of purported reasons for that. One is the nature of who we are as veterinarians, and that's an overgeneralization, but we tend to be introverts. We tend to be highly compassionate. We work hard in long hours. We become isolated from family. Divorce is high. But most recently, I think personally, the main reason that's factored in on top of that are twofold. One is the economic burden because of the debt load of our students. And also, particularly in the economic downturn in 2000, 2008, 2009, and I think we still see this, is at one point, 25% of our patients that were coming into the emergency room of our small animal hospital were euthanized. And that is because of lack of finances. Mm-hmm. That leads to what we refer to as compassion fatigue or empathy fatigue. And that is a real issue. And so, you know, veterinarians have access to the medications that you euthanize animals. And so many times that's one manner in which someone tries to take their life. So I think trying to really get a grip on this access to care and being able to provide all pets with some level of care, doesn't have to be, you know, at the highest level, but some level of care not only is really important for the pet and the pet parent, but is also going to be good for the mental health and well-being of those in the veterinary profession, which is not just veterinarians. It also includes veterinary technicians mm-hmm. or nurses and veterinary assistants.
And when we're talking about access to care and trying to increase these options, we have another email from Cynthia. She writes that she's a senior, she has two dogs, and lives on a small income. She's visited several of these different services to get low-cost vaccinations, but the problem she encounters is that the programs are short on funds, so their longevity is short. And I'm wondering how you build a program like this to last. And we were talking with Dr. Millward last segment. You know, she mentioned this has been going on for 10 years, so that's a pretty good track record. But how do you make sure these can sustain themselves into the future?
That's one of the questions that funding agencies ask us all the time when we start a program. Okay, how are you going to sustain it?
Yeah.
And we were fortunate. We started this program with a grant from the Kenneth Scott Trust back in 2009. But fortunately, through a variety of sources, including a number of donors, we have been able to sustain this. And this is through things called, like, we have a fund called the Angel Fund. We have an outreach medicine fund that people donate to. We have a Good Samaritan Fund. And so people who want to help others, pets or people, donate to those, which helps us. We work very closely with pharmaceutical companies as well as pet food companies to get pet food and supplies donated or get them at low cost. As an example, the Blue Buffalo Company back in about 2016 started sending short-dated pet food products to one of our organizations that we work with. We sort of facilitated it. It's through Faithful Forgotten Best Friends. They literally get semi-truckloads of it. And this is not expired food. It's short-dated, which means they can't put it on the shelf, but it can be used. And by doing that, that organization can spend its resources on medical supplies and medical care so they don't have to spend it on buying pet food. And another thing I might add is back with Life Care Alliance, it was our veterinarians who were first to observe that the folks being provided meals through Meals on Wheels were actually feeding their pets their meals. And now Life Care Alliance, several years ago, started delivering pet food to those people they serve who have pets.
So I was really looking at those intersections of where multiple issues might be happening.
And partnering.
And partnering with them. Well, and Joelle, I want to turn back to the Honoring the Bond program because I love the title of it. Because I think that sometimes people who don't own pets don't understand why the death of a pet hits someone so hard or is so difficult. Can you help explain that?
Well, I think it's just true. And it's something that I say to owners very often is there are people out there that just don't get it. And they might not ever get it. But surely those people that do get it really, really get it and understand. And so there are times when I will hear people say, well, what do you mean you're a social worker for people and pets? That's ridiculous. Well, it might be ridiculous to that particular person, but the reality is it's more and more common that people do accept it. So the loss that people experience often when they lose a pet, often it's harder than losing, for example, a parent.
Really?
And that's not always true, right? So, and I'm talking about older parents,
sure,
right? So because the relationship that we have with our animals, they are relying on us typically unconditionally. They live much shorter than humans do. So often when a parent dies, again, if it's an older, you know, an elderly parent, they've, quote, lived a good life, or that was an expected thing. With the animals, very often, for many of the people that I work with, they're very isolated, and their animal is their only source of support. Maybe their family or friends have left them, and so this animal is really the one giving them that unconditional love. And it's not true for everyone.
Sure. And it's also the person that they're living with day to day, or not the person.
Exactly. The being
that is with them every single day, day in, day
exactly.
out.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, if I could add in, I also think it's difficult or more difficult for pet parents because many of their friends, family, colleagues don't understand what they're going through. So I mean, you hear many times, well, what do you mean your pet, you know, get over it? Well, they don't have the same opportunities for grieving, and people don't understand the grief they're going through. So I think they probably internalize it and aren't able to properly grieve. And I think that's one of the great things about the Honoring the Bond program and the work that Joelle does is she helps them through that process of grief.
A lot of times it's just seeing the grief as valid.
Absolutely. I think many of the owners that I work with say there must be something wrong with me. What, you know, I must be crazy. You must think I'm crazy for grieving my animal. And my answer typically to that is there's a reason they employ me here, right? So if this was something that was unusual, there wouldn't be a need for someone like me. And so many of the conversations I have with owners is just normalizing what their experience is and saying that it is okay to grieve. It's appropriate and expected.
Yeah. Well, and grief is different for every person, but can you give us some suggestions that you have found are universally helpful for people who are either making these decisions mm-hmm. or going through the grief of losing a pet?
Sure. Well, I think the one of the biggest things that I say to people is really, you're not alone. Not that that negates their experience, but just to understand that other people have gone through it and have made it through it. So usually people, when I'm dealing with when they're dealing with grief, it's very intense in the moment. And to say it's really hard right now. Being open to talking to people. So some of the owners that I work with may need or want longer term therapy. And so I can make referrals out or give recommendations to people in the community to help them along. Again, being able to memorialize their animal in some way. And there's so many different ways and so many different things that people can do. The biggest thing with just grief in general is being having that opportunity to talk and to remember. And sometimes the owner needs to repeat things over and over again and be heard. And I think that's the thing that's important is to have a listening ear. And it might sound very simple, but it's not always as simple as that.
And it's not always present.
Exactly.
And you talk about the need to remember. There are increased memorialization options now,
yes.
too, right? Can you tell us about those?
Oh, my gosh. There's so many different things that people do. I think one of the examples of what we do in the College of Veterinary Medicine is we have a yearly remembrance ceremony. And it's really a formalized celebration of those animals that have died in the past year. And you don't typically see that for animals. You know, with humans, there's funerals, and that's typical. You don't typically see animal funerals, although I have had clients that have done that. But there's all kinds of things that people can do. I have a list on our website, I've had clients that have portraits of their animals. A lot of people will make jewelry in some manner, whether it's a paw print, a nose print is a big thing now that people are doing, is making jewelry with their pet's nose print on it. Some people will do something like planting a tree or a flower in memory of their pet. A lot of people will make donations in the name of their animal to any number of places that would accept a donation.
Yeah. In terms of grieving processes, is it a smart idea to get another pet? That's an option that we have when a pet dies that we don't have, obviously, with any other type of grieving, mm-hmm. where we can indeed, you know, go and add another animal to our life if we want. What sort of advice do you mm-hmm. give around that process of adding a new member to your family, so to speak?
Absolutely. So that's a question I get quite often. I don't encourage people to go out right away and do that. However, there are some owners that I work with that say, I just like having another being in my home. And I think the important thing is every person is going to be different. And so I just want them to be ready for it and be able to grieve the loss of their current animal. And know that they're not replacing that. So that's the biggest thing, is that I totally understand folks wanting to have another animal in their home. And I totally accept, you know, that for them. Just knowing that that's not the expectation that they're going to replace the animal. It's just bringing another life into their home. Mm. And I think it's appropriate. A lot of people do choose to do that. And then I have other clients that say, I'm never going to get an animal again. And I also will accept that. But what I usually say is, and that's okay. And you may change your mind.
Yeah. And you can. You're
exactly.
allowed to. You're
exactly.
allowed to.
And they do.
Yes, they do.
Dr. Rustin Moore, before we go, when you look at the future of access to veterinary care and truly holistic pet owner and pet care, what do you think of as your top priority going forward with OSU VetMed?
Well, I think our top priority is continuing to move along the lines that I mentioned earlier about spectrum of care. Spectrum of care is really providing a broad array of services to a broad array of clients along that socioeconomic array or that spectrum. That means teaching our students how to provide various levels of care when they graduate to a wide variety of people that have various financial situations. It's a bigger issue than just here at our college, and I think you'll see, and we are seeing a number of other schools do this. It's a profession-wide issue. Mm-hmm. I think as we continue to see disparities in the sort of the income of the highest and the lowest, and there's fewer and fewer in the middle, that we're going to continue to see these issues, and it's something that we're definitely focused on.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Rustin Moore, Dean of the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine, and Joelle Nielsen, Program Coordinator for Honoring the Bond. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.